talk will come up. Okay.
Oh, then you luck for the audience, it won't come up.
Okay, the KRC thermal model for analysis of Mars infrared mapping in honor of PRC by Hugh Kiefer.
Well, I like that last slide that you showed before this one because of that list of things at the bottom. There's only one of that whole list where Phil hasn't made some kind of a contribution. I'm not even sure that that one shouldn't be on the list. So it's really really fitting. I'm very pleased to be here. I started out trying to give two parallel talks. On the left, you'll see lots of words and things about thermal models and the history of thermal models, and I'll just spend a little time on those. Mostly on the right will be things about a career, and I think that's where everybody's interest will lie, so you can skip worrying about all the science in this. There's plenty of science to come in the later talks. I met Phil as an undergraduate at UCLA about 1974. He tells me, he actually told me this before, that he met me and his eventually-to-be wife on the same day. So I guess they about balanced out in terms of contributions to his life. And then he was an undergraduate, and he worked with me as an intern on the thermal mapping, the IRTM infrared thermal mapper on the Viking mission, which was a really incredible time for everybody, and I'm sure he remembers it well. And he liked it well enough that he went on to actually write a thesis using the data from that experiment on mapping of Mars' surface physical properties, basically rocks and sand, which he still knows and loves. Thermal mapping works best in a dry environment without the complications of rainfall or evaporation or vegetation, so Phil went to ASU. And there he started a program of thermal instrument development. About 1990, he was doing well enough that ASU gave him a building, and so he stayed there ever since. So my goal here is mostly to just tell you about Phil's background. I've had some help getting some of this information together, which I much appreciate, but for reasons which will become soon obvious, all those people must remain unnamed. So I accept full responsibility. How's it go these days? My name is Hugh Kiefer, and I endorse this message or something like that. Okay, let's see if I can make this thing work with the down button. There we go. This will give you a flavor of what's to come. He started, I guess, must have started about 1953 or 4, and this model started not much later than that, about 1967 or 8, and the thermal model began in the era of kilohertz mainframes, if any of you remember what those things were, and that's bear some relevance when I do talk about this model as to the way I actually put it together. And here's an overview from a high point of the global model. It's all of it's laid out here. I'm not going to really bore you with all this stuff. But basically, it's try to map it, to get temperatures for an entire planet. Because you can measure temperatures, but if you're trying to get to the properties of the planet, you need something to convert. It's like, you know, having a sentence without a dictionary. You have temperatures, you get a model, and that leads you to the physical properties of the surface. This model runs seasons, latitudes, days, layers, blah, 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 blah. When I started this, which is about the same era, to run one case for a given albedo, thermal inertia, and everything for 19 latitudes for one Martian year took an hour on the world's largest unclassified computer. At that time, UCLA had an IBM 36091. It took up an entire floor of a building. It had 1 megabyte of memory, and I could run my model in an hour, which was pretty expensive in those days. I was using the university's computing capability for an hour to run one model. Consequently, I put a great deal of effort into making this thing run lickety-split, and it pretty much does. is, you know, the only problem with Phil and his telescope is I think he didn't understand optics very well at this point. Here's it's just a cartoon of basically what's going on. You got a spacecraft up here is looking down. It has to look through a dusty atmosphere. So the model worries about the solar scattering of the and heating in the solar region. It worries about infrared opacity and heating in the atmosphere and changing the brightness temperature that you see from above versus the surface kinetic temperature. And there's all kinds of shenanigans that go on underneath the surface to try to represent Mars in a simplistic way. The one big shortcoming in this model is there's no direct conduction from the surface to the atmosphere, but it does a lot of other stuff. Communicating between functions. So I decided to do this in Fortran and use Commons. Phil decided to meet his wife at UCLA, and then she went off to San Francisco Med Center, and he was at UCLA, so he was doing a lot of communications back and forth. He liked to bicycle. I don't know if he ever actually bicycled up to San Francisco for a date or not. Wouldn't surprise me. All the inputs are in one package. You'll see Phil's holding a little package here, which we'll get to in a minute. Basically, and if you've ever tried to run KRC, it looks a lot like an image of a deck of cards, and there's because that's where it came from. But Phil, notice the size satchel he has here. I don't know if you've known Phil very well, but he still carries an enormous satchel with him. It's usually, you know, monster thing. And in order to be able to do that, he had to work out. So Phil's done upper body workout all his life, and you'll see more of that in a few minutes. Obscure and mystical properties that... The model has a lot of really intricate treachery in it, and there's a bunch of big words over here for all the strange things I did to make it run fast. Now, I don't know when this picture was taken, but I doubt that any of you are going to have trouble picking the era of this picture, at least. Phil's gone through quite a few changes in life. Ambivalence is a picture of ambivalence. What do I want to be in life, Dad? What am I going to do next? Well, the model, parallel in the model is when you measure surface temperatures, some of it comes from the fine particles, some of it comes from the rocks on Mars. There's lots of rocks. And if you work a little bit, particularly making observations at day when the rocks dominate and night when the fine materials, sorry, day, the other way around, in the daytime when the fines dominate because they're hot and at night when the rocks dominate because they're hot, you can actually separate out the fraction of rocks and the size of the fines. Phil made a career out of this, basically. He's done very well at it. He's the world's expert on this, and it's used very commonly now in trying to... It's one of the aspects of picking a landing site on Mars. This is a little diagram of a bunch of things. Just a little bit of introduction to the audience. Here's some black body curves, 145 Kelvin, the coldest it gets on Mars, we thought. 230, a typical sort of mid-afternoon temperature. 270, a typical midday temperature. And then 330 that goes off, the 300 here goes off the top is the hottest it ever gets on Mars. And the line in this wavelength dimension are the two bands of the first radiometer that went to Mars. Two bands, one detector each, flybys on Mariner 6 and 7, and then a mapping orbiter with 9, basically the same instrument. And that's the first one I was involved in. And then my child, more or less the IRTM, had detectors. And the big difference here is we added bands so we could look at the atmospheric temperature in the CO2 band. We added a band to measure the total solar reflected energy, and had 7 detectors in each band in each one of these telescopes. It was a very successful experiment. It spawned a lot of papers, a lot of students, a pretty good bunch of science. And these were both uncooled. Phil, everything beyond that has been Phil's instrument. The next one was a thermal emission spectrometer, the first of which was lost on Mars Observer when the whole spacecraft disappeared. But he took a big jump forward in making an interferometer, and this blue band basically shows you the range of wavelengths that it covered, and here's an example of what the bands look like roughly. They're 5 wave number bands, so they vary with wave number rather than wavelength. An extremely successful experiment, which resulted in mapping the Mars atmosphere and the Mars surface and mineralogy and all kinds of wonderful things you'll hear later today, with 3 kilometer resolution. And then Phil took a big gamble and jumped a factor of 1,000 in aerial resolution and went to Themis, which is 100 meter resolution, 5 bands in the visible to do a little color mapping, 9 bands in the infrared to do mineralogy. And so now we're approaching mineralogy with 100 meter resolution at the surface. Themis is still operating. The MGS test was lost when the spacecraft quit before the instrument did. One more jump down to the surface with mini tests. It looks a lot like the big test. I forgot to mention there's also this orange line is a thermal bolometer that measures all the way out to 100 microns. So it basically gets the total energy at any one of these temperatures. Mini test doesn't have the bolometer, it doesn't have the solar stuff, but it does have an interferometer. And it's a thermal infrared interferometer operating in ambient conditions on the surface of Mars. It's pretty amazing, a little gizzy. And there's been some problems with one of them, but they've basically been very successful experiments. The whole business about thermal inertia, you're probably familiar with these curves. As you get fine material, you get big excursions through the day. Rocks don't excurse very much. And one of the problems with Themis has been, and this is, many of you may know this, Themis has been running at this time of day, a very difficult time of day for thermal instruments, in order to keep the gamma ray spectrometer cool. So it's a constraint on the spacecraft to allow the gamma ray spectrometer to operate. After several years, Themis is now, Odyssey is in the process of going to a 2:30 time, and you should see this kind of resolution. Things are going to be dramatically, it's going to be almost a new experiment. Should be wonderful. Less confusing, good science data. KRC can have different materials. Down at the bottom, you can have bedrock or ice or anything if you want. And then the upper layers can be some other lower thermal inertia material. Here's Phil pointing at a gap between, actually represents almost 1 billion years. And this isn't loose, but it's aggregated sands. It's somewhat appropriate to the thermal models. You can see why Phil can carry a heavy satchel around with them. There's an atmosphere in the model, and here's it's a CO2 atmosphere. Here's all kinds of fancy stuff about it. Here's a pair of my graduate students. I'm afraid I have to claim some responsibility for both of these characters, creating a CO2 atmosphere in a balloon with a bottle of beer. We've gone back and forth between models. The Viking and Themis and Minitest used the KRC model. The test actually was based on a thermal model run by Mike Mellon, based on stuff by Bruce Tchaikovsky. So we've gone back and forth there. Phil used to go back and forth in a Jeep, and I don't know if he still has this Jeep. The last time I saw it was fairly beat up. I don't think it looked quite this bad, but Phil loves to drive his Jeep. There's also snow and frost in the thermal model. You can condense in the surface. You can condense in the atmosphere. It does global integrations, keep track of the mass. The surface pressure goes up and down based on the polar cap growth and so forth. And on the right, we have Phil with a bunch of ice. I don't know where this picture was taken. I was looking at this. I was wondering, is that a lift ticket by any chance? Is he off skiing? The thing I noticed all of a sudden was, look at the jacket he's wearing. Those of you who know Phil knows that although he lives in Phoenix, he has a favorite heavy leather jacket. What is this guy thinking, I wonder? And you have mixes of rocks and finds. A lot of science has been done with that. Here's a mix of characters on the right. Here's a couple of guys who have dreamed up what we'd like to do at Mars and what kind of instrument might do it. And on the outside are the two guys who have actually make it work. This is Steve Silverman, who has been the lead engineer on all of Phil's instruments. This is Stillman Chase, who actually started designing instruments before I got to know him. And as of right now, he's still helping design instruments for Phil. So this guy's been at it. He's for 40 years. He's an amazingly clever, successful engineer. And without these guys on the outside, the two guys on the inside wouldn't have gotten very far. There's been some evolution of the model. It's over the years, it's evolved by capabilities. And I know it's been used by at least four generations of academic students at this point. Here's Phil with one of his students and one of my older students, and they're setting some kind of an example for this guy. I don't even drink beer, so I have no idea why, you know, what's going on here. There are many ways to use a model. You can use it for slope effects, rock proportions, spin up for a year, and then go down to time intervals as short as a few minutes. There's a one-point moment we'll talk about. Here's some other questionable variation of use. There are five guys in this picture. And where's the one who's working? See, he's up here. There's one guy working. Here's the rest of these characters, and here's Phil, and I don't know what this thing is. It just sort of snuck in there somehow. The one-point mode was made for Themis because people wanted results at one point fast. So I made a way you could just put in one line. On one line, you could list the season, latitude, hour, day, surface elevation, abathymetric, interstitial, solar, opacity, surface slope, and slope azimuth. And it would output the surface kinetic temperature and the top of the atmosphere brightness temperature for the bolometer at that point. And so that's the one-point model, and it's cheap and easy, and it's another interface to this big mess. Here's one point getting ready to solo into space. If they just had only closed the chamber before he got out, it would have been a different life. Heavy-duty work. Here's some guys doing heavy-duty work, maybe. The model, actually, the way it's actually run for big missions is you pre-compute hundreds of models now on a grid of all these things. The green ones are location, basically. Then you extract the information for that location, figure out what you think the albedo and dust opacity are at the time, down interpolate till you just get temperatures versus thermal inertia, take your observation, do a strange interpolation into temperature, and you get the thermal inertia. Now, this is Steve again. He went back and forth between long hair also. I think this is the Odyssey launch. I'm not sure. Effective particle size on Mars. This is the only little bit of science really in this thing. I just did this recently. I took the Than Pudsick's latest map of test-derived thermal inertia for all of Mars, weighted it by area, and this is a logarithmic scale over here because we're really plotting grain size versus thermal inertia. And the blue line is the distribution, the statistical distribution of thermal inertia on Mars, and you see it peaks up here around 150 in modern units, which is roughly fine sand. And if you just look at the top 10%, from 5 to 95%, you'll see that most of Mars is in the silt and sand range. And then there's this weird distribution at the high end. This is mixtures of rocks, and up here even exposed bedrock at the 3-kilometer scale. Success at finding water. Phil's, this instrument's helped find water in a variety of ways near the South Pole, the hematite story, and the melting dusty snow gully story, which is still some under debate. There's Phil with a lot of water behind him. A little water in his pool at his spa. Phil and Candy have this collection. Phil has this collection of bottles of sand. I mean, really, he's a PhD scientist. He plays with bottles of sand. He's got lots of them in his house. And a marine aquarium, so they needed a bigger house. So Phil and Candy went and built a bigger house. Those of you who have been to your house, his house, will know this is only a mild exaggeration. There's a doctor and his new child. This is the birth of Themis over here, this thingy right here. And as I mentioned, it's a factor of 1,000 in area resolution. The problem is you have to control the detectors. Even though they're ambient, you have to control them to a millikelvin. The guy you saw before, Steve Silverman, in order to get this thing to work, in the last year before launch, he took 2 days off, including vacations and holidays. And that's partly an example of the kind of leadership Phil can provide to get people to work, whether they should or not. And it's the kind of engineering support it really takes to make good instruments. Here's a picture of Phil in the thermal infrared, taken with his own child, Themis. Here's the rest of the group just after they finally got it to work. My note here, it's a moment of play after years of work, or maybe they just didn't think it was actually working at the time. Phil has been a wonderful leader in education programs, including a highly successful K-12 program that he started, and Sherry is here someplace who's run that for many years. Not shown in this picture, though the kiddies would have enjoyed it, are all the Lego models Phil has made of spacecraft and instruments. You really should see those someday. He's unselfish in supporting many NASA panels and reviews. He travels a lot, so he got this thing on eBay. Here's a picture of his main support group. Again, Steve Silverman, Greg Mehal, who manages everything except the instrument, and Tara Hayden Fisher, who's invisible as usual, and she's the office manager and the group mom. The real team behind the success, these are his kids, circa 2000, kids and wife. I thought, there's an enthusiastic individual right there. We're getting toward the end here. So one of the things KRC can do is tell you how deep it can make thermal models as a function of depth to ice. And this is a series of shallow versus surface temperatures and ice surface temperatures at depth, depths and scale ice. You multiply those by about 5 to get centimeters. And Josh Banfield, one of Phil's students, did this in detail where the Phoenix was going to land. So here's a map of the thermal depth to ice from Themis, which had 6 centimeters, and Tess, which had about 4.5 centimeters. And as you know, this was basically bang on what was actually found. This is a group of students and other people on one of Phil's many field trips. He loves to lead field trips. I've enjoyed it. There are at least 5 instrument PIs in this picture. He's been inspiring in a bunch of ways. This is quite a good cast of characters, and I think they've all enjoyed dealing with Phil over many years. What next? I don't know. I'm going to try to finally publish the thermal model. Phil has shown these attributes of dedication, leadership, thoughtfulness, attention to detail, and helping out people when they really need it. All the things that make a successful academic environment, inspiring leadership, and I'm most pleased to be here to help introduce you to him as he receives the Gilbert Award. Thank you.
We have a couple minutes for comments or maybe even rebuttal if anybody would like to make a comment or ask Hugh a question about his experiences with Phil or the model if you want. Anyway?
I forgot one thing, guys.
Do it.
If you looked at all those pictures of Phil when he was wearing pants, they were always jeans. If you look at him right now, you'll see he's not wearing jeans. This must be a really important day for Phil.
Thank you, Hugh. We do have a moment or two, okay, before we actually have to go to the next talk. And so I think what I'm going to do is we have a whole series of speakers who I'm sure have their own comments to make along with their scientific presentation, but some of you in the audience may not have that opportunity otherwise. If there's somebody who would like to say one or two things before we go to the next talk, please stand up and tell us who you are and what your relationship is, and share with us if you'd like. Otherwise, we're going to sit here for another minute and 30 seconds. How about you, Phil? You want to say? You want to make any response? Well, then let's... Yeah, you do. So let's move on to the next talk, which is by Vicki Hamilton.